He was governor of Wisconsin from 1931 to 1933 and from 1935 to 1939, elected as a member of the Progressive Party of Wisconsin. The gregarious governor known as Phil on the streets of Madison during his governorship did much to further the cause of progressivism, as his father, Bob, Fighting Bob, had done also before him. And he also saw the implementation of many of the progressive measures of the New Deal. He was defeated running for re-election in 1938. His name? Philip La Follette. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
Where did the La Follette political phenomenon come from, and how much did the family influence the way Wisconsin is run today? And why was Philip La Follette on the cover of Time magazine in 1928? What is the legacy of that influential political family? Joining us for some answers is Jonathan Kasparek, author of Fighting Sun, the first full-scale biography of Philip La Follette, a 2006 publication of the University of Wisconsin Press.
And welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
You know, it occurs to me we don't have an equivalent political family to the La Follettes. Almost everyone recognizes the name La Follette. It's a real icon, the Fighting Bob La Follette symbol. And I can't think of another family that you could say that about in Wisconsin politics.
There really isn't. La Follette was around for a long time. When he died in 1925, one of the persons at his funeral quipped, "It's hard to know what to say about Fighting Bob. He lived 150 years. not quite, but he was certainly around for a long time. Elected district attorney of Dane County in 1880, and then representative, governor, United States senator. When he died in 1925, his older son, Robert Jr., sort of inherited the Senate seat and served until 1946 when he lost to the other famous Wisconsin politician, Joe McCarthy. And then his younger son, Philip, governor in the 1930s. And then a grandson, Bronson La Follette, attorney general until 1989, I think. So over 100 years, the La Follette family has been around and influencing the state.
Where did it come from, and was politics part of the family before Fighting Bob came onto the scene?
Well, La Follette went into politics because he was too short to be an actor, quite frankly.
Well, there is a lot of similarity
It's certainly theatrical. He was born in Primrose and comes to the University of Wisconsin as a young man, ill-prepared for school, but is an orator and becomes famous for winning an interstate oratorical competition. Just like we welcomed the Badgers home from the Rose Bowl a few years ago, he came back to Wisconsin, this great hero, for speaking. And, well, you go into acting, of course, if you're a good speaker, but he was too short, a fairly short man, 5'4", I think, and not much of a stage presence. So the next best thing was being a lawyer, and after that, the logical thing was politics.
And did he come from a family already committed to social justice causes?
Not particularly, no. His family moved to Wisconsin when he was born here, shortly before his birth. They were steadfast Republicans, because in the Civil War era in Wisconsin, you had to be a steadfast Republican, pretty much. But not particularly committed to justice. They weren't well off. The one big influence in his childhood was a very overbearing, tyrannical stepfather. And a lot of his energy and sort of interest in reform and insurgency begins really rebelling against this authority figure. And rebellion against authority figures is the hallmark of his career, really.
What would have been the political climate in Wisconsin as Bob La Follette was coming onto the scene?
Well, the Republicans pretty much ran things. The Democrats were the party of disunion and secession and civil war.
And did Republican mean sort of the opposite at that point still?
Republicanism began in Wisconsin as a liberal reform party, which is important to remember. They were opposed specifically to the Kansas-Nebraska Act, that is, extending slavery westward.
1854.
Correct. And they also came out in favor of free land for homesteaders and trying to encourage westward migration. La Follette certainly is influenced by that. By the time he's a young man, Republicanism had changed somewhat. And increasingly, Wisconsin politics is dominated by a handful of party bosses. And politics becomes a matter of patronage. Who can get the most federal money and the federal jobs? How can you reward the followers? Who do you pick to run for election? So La Follette is brought up in that and is a fairly conventional politician at first.
What kind of avenue into public office does he take then? What is his first election?
It's very conventional. He is fresh out of law school. He's a practicing lawyer, a good courtroom performer, but limps along knowing quite what the law is. And he decides he's going to run for district attorney. That's where you start a career, and it's great experience. His version of the story is that he decided this because he needed the money. It paid the grand sum of $800 a year. So this was the way to get an income so that he could marry his fiancée, Belle Case of Baraboo. He went to the post office to pick up his mail, and he encounters the postmaster, Elisha Keyes, who was the boss of Dane County. And he rebuked La Follette for deciding to run, saying, "We've already got this other candidate picked up. You have to wait your turn. Politics is about being fair and being rewarded for faithful service." And La Follette was jumping the queue. He hadn't done anything yet to really earn an elected position. He runs anyway, gets the nomination, and is elected and serves two terms as district attorney. Got a quite successful record as district attorney. That's his version. There's not a great deal of contemporary evidence to suggest that Keyes actually put up that much of a fight. Perhaps he knew an up-and-comer when he saw one and knew how to pick his battles, I guess. After 2 years of being a district attorney, his mentor, George Bryant, suggests he should run for Congress. And so he runs for the 2nd District, which included Madison and parts of southern Wisconsin, and is elected in 1884. And he's a very conventional congressman.
Pretty young congressman.
The youngest congressman at the time. And he shows some early streaks of independence. He opposes, for example, an effort by some lumber barons to seize timberlands on the Menominee Reservation. We managed to stop that. There was a ship subsidy bill that was going to be a great boon for ship manufacturers, and he works against that. But he's a very conventional Republican. He sort of does what's conventional for Republicans. He votes for the tariff. You know, he still equates Democrats as somewhat treasonous, perhaps, and becomes very good friends with William McKinley, who goes on to be elected president. He supports McKinley, generally regarded as a fairly conservative politician throughout his career.
But a trust buster without necessarily getting a lot of publicity for it, McKinley was.
Well, he was certainly a very good president and has perhaps the beginnings of the progressive era that we usually associate with Teddy Roosevelt.
And did moving to Washington change La Follette?
Not really. He and his wife, Belle, and their daughter, Fola, enjoyed Washington. Washington was socially a place to experience new things. They went to the theater, they went to concerts, they heard opera, they went to see plays and performances. Belle was a little bit uncomfortable with society, but she did the dutiful thing by calling on fellow congressional wives and being respectful. And they furnished their house with books and other very middle-class, comfortable surroundings. And they enjoyed it, I think.
I guess I was wondering whether, after he saw the way politics worked, whether some of what later would become his activism and his ability to stand as the only one who might vote against something came about. When he went to Washington, did he start to, I guess, get cynical about politics?
Well, he doesn't get cynical until he loses his job.
Oh, okay.
What happens is this. In 1890, Democrats, for a variety of reasons, resurge in Wisconsin, and all of the Republican office holders are swept out except for a few. Niels Haugen, I think, survived. So he's out of a job. This had very profound implications. For years, Republicans had pretty much controlled state government, and they were the state treasurers. And there was a series of state treasurers who participated in a very time-honored, well-known bit of graft. They deposited state money in banks owned by fellow Republicans and kept the interest. And they used this as a sort of slush fund.
They personally kept the interest?
Well, it went into a party-controlled fund, and that was where they financed elections and helped out people. So the Democrats are brought into power in 1890, and well, they're going to fix that. And they file a lawsuit prosecuting those treasurers to recover this money, which now is thousands and thousands of dollars. And they go not only after the treasurers, they also go after those who had been their bondsmen, those who had guaranteed their good behavior. And one of those was Philetus Sawyer, the lumber baron from Oshkosh, who had been, until 1890, a United States senator. So what happens is this. La Follette is requested by Sawyer to come meet him in Milwaukee. And they meet in a hotel lobby in Milwaukee. And Sawyer tells him what's going on, that he stands to lose lots of money through these treasury cases. And he says, I don't want you to go to court. And he pulls out a wad of cash. He says, but I want you to fix the case. Well, the judge in the case was his brother-in-law, Robert Seebecker. Well, La Follette, of course, puts two and two together and is horrified that this party boss is offering him a bribe to influence the outcome of these cases. And he throws up his hands and is very angry and sort of self-righteous and storms out. Sawyer insisted that he hadn't meant that, that he had been misunderstood. But eventually, when Seebecker steps down as judge from the case, it all starts to come out. And suddenly, La Follette is a very unpopular man. And he'd been a faithful Republican. He had been a speaker who campaigned for Republicans. Now nobody wanted anything to do with him. This is the big turning point. This is when La Follette suddenly sees what's been going on. And sort of everything that had happened in the past, from Elisha Keys to the Menominee Reservation timber deal, it was all a plot. It was all this persistent attempt by wealthy industrialists and their purchased political allies to use the democratic system to enrich themselves at the expense of democracy and at the expense of everyone else. So that's the big turning point.
Sounds very contemporary.
And does he go on the stump then at this point to put a stop to this?
Well, sort of. He becomes very much determined to overthrow the political machine. This fits in well with what he'd been doing earlier in trying to advance his own career probably faster than the bosses wanted to. But he's out to limit their power. He goes about it fairly cautiously. He does not pursue the Republican nomination at first, and he sort of convinces his friend Niels Haugen to do that in 1892, to sort of test the waters and see, does this reform effort have any legs? Will it work? What kind of power do the bosses really have? And Haugen loses the nomination in the Republican convention. This is, of course, before primary elections, when the party bosses met in a convention and delegates picked who the candidates were going to be. He tries again. And he alternates between advancing his own career and talking about issues of reform, the primary election law, which he does not invent. He borrows that idea from others, promoting that, but also campaigning for his friend McKinley in 1896 and again in 1900 as sort of a reliable, effective Republican speaker. So he's almost playing both sides. But it's in the 1890s where he really begins to challenge the power of the bosses and get the nomination for himself.
And between the time when he's the House a representative and the time when he's governor, is he earning money by being a lawyer?
He's a lawyer. He is a public speaker. He goes on the Chautauqua circuit, that lecture circuit in the Midwest and Northeast, a very popular speaker, and that brings in a lot of money. The La Follettes were always not well off. They were always hard up for money, and it was always a struggle for them to maintain enough of an income to maintain their lifestyle and to sort of finance these struggles. And that continues well in the 1930s, the next generation as well.
What is Fighting Bob's appeal? Actually, where does he come up with that nickname in the first place? And how does he have a power base then to run for governor? What prompts him to do that?
Well, his power base comes from what we would call grassroots organizing. Growing up in Dane County was a good place to grow up. He knew lots of farmers. He picked up some Norwegian so he could speak to people in Norwegian, which is an attraction. And he would go door to door and talk to people, hear about what their issues were and convince them to support. And he kept files. If you go to the Historical Society archives, there are boxes of his
who's who
note cards.
Who wants what?
Well, not who knows what, but who people are. So he could address everyone and get them to support him. Fighting Bob really comes from his efforts to reform government and his campaign style. He's really the last, I think, of the 19th century great orators. He would speak for 2 hours and people would love listening to him. And it wasn't just speaking, it was acting. This is where his theatrical background comes into play. And he'll stand on a hay wagon and he'll harangue the people. He'll take his coat off. He'll wear a hat. He'll take his hat off. He'll wave his arms about. And people would listen to him enthralled, and he would go on about democracy. And
he's Wisconsin's William Jennings Bryan.
Very similar to William Jennings Bryan. In fact, some of the very earliest synchronized motion picture sound recording we have is of La Follette in 1924. They taped Calvin Coolidge, and then they taped La Follette. They're both running for president. Calvin Coolidge, they had to turn the volume up, and they forgot to turn it down for La Follette. So when they La Follette does his projecting voice, they had to replace the equipment because he broke it.
How did he do as governor?
Well, he had a very successful 5 years as governor. He was elected in 1900 and reelected in 1902 and 1904. And he secured a number of very significant reforms. The big industry in Wisconsin was the railroads. And that's whom he perceived to be the sort of money power corrupting politics. And so he wanted to curb the power of the railroads. This had been an issue for decades in Wisconsin. There had been earlier attempts at railroad reforms, that railroads that discriminated against farmers or overcharged for transporting goods. And they had a gimmick that they used to allegedly get political favors, the free pass. Politicians could ride on railroads and have goods shipped for free.
Yeah, that sounds like that would be a problem. A little conflict of interest there.
And La Follette knew how to really make this work to his advantage. The governor in the end of the 19th century, Edward Schofield, lived in Oconto. And it became known to La Follette that he had lots of his belongings shipped from Oconto to Madison for free, including one cow crated up. And this crated up cow became famous for a time, as La Follette talked about this as an example of the influence the corporate world had on politics. So he does a number of things. Railroad regulation, the Railroad Commission is created to make sure that railroads are playing fair and not discriminating. Railroad taxation was an issue. Railroads paid very little taxes because they only pay taxes on their reported profits. And just as we discovered within the past few years, corporations have wonderful ways of using bookkeeping techniques to hide profit. So the charge that the progressives made is that the state is nearing bankruptcy and the railroads are getting all of this money and they're not sharing. So taxation based on the assessed value of railroad property, like we all have to pay our property taxes at the end of the month, railroad have to pay their taxes at the same rates.
So I can see where Fighting Bob would be a popular governor.
Mm-hmm. Oh, popular among many people, unpopular among others.
You mentioned Belle La Follette, who is in her own right kind of an interesting figure as well. Can you give us some background on her and what kind of role she was playing during this time that he was either in the House of Representatives or governor?
Belle played a critical role, and I think the argument could be made that there wouldn't have been a Fighting Bob had there not been a Belle. She was a very intelligent woman, much better in college than he was. She was the star pupil. La Follette barely graduated. Literally, the faculty almost didn't pass him, and John Bascom convinced them to graduate him. Belle was the very intelligent one. She helped prepare his law cases, and when La Follette had to argue before the Supreme Court, the case had been prepared by Belle. And the justice complimented La Follette on putting together such a wonderful, well-prepared brief. He hadn't done it. It had been his wife.
And she was the first one to get a law degree from Wisconsin,
she
right?
was. And she went to UW Law School. She was the first woman to get a law degree. She never practiced. She certainly could have, would have been a very good lawyer. But she did it because it was intellectual. She was an intelligent woman, and this is something that was interested. And I think, as many people believe, if you want to engage in a career that teaches you how to think and how to communicate, law is a pretty good one to do. She never wanted a public career, though. She was always sort of in the background. The only time she really comes into her own sort of political activity is for suffrage. And she's one of the leading advocates for suffrage and gives speeches for suffrage. She was very shy, and so it took a great deal of energy and courage to stand up and talk about suffrage and demand the right to vote or testify before Congress. And she did it wonderfully. She was a very good speaker when she worked herself up to do it. The other critical role she played, too, was in keeping La Follette healthy. La Follette suffered from a variety of ailments, nervous exhaustion, digestive trouble, as he put it, and she was continually nursing him back to health. And he'd have these periodic outbreaks where he'd be sick for months. And she nursed him and kept him going and provided psychological support that he needed.
Sounds as if she also served as mother to a whole group of important political figures as well.
She certainly is a matriarch in this sense. And she provided the same kind of support and encouragement to her children as well.
More on the La Follette family when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Jonathan Kasparek, and we're talking about the La Follette family. And at the moment, about Fighting Bob, who's made this interesting transition. He has been governor of Wisconsin for 5 years, 1901 to 1906, and I gather has accomplished a good deal as governor. And then in 1906, he becomes United States Senator from Wisconsin, which seems an unusual career path. Why that?
Well, he wanted to be president, quite frankly. I mean, he's aiming for the top, and becoming a member of the United States Senate was very prestigious then, as it is now, only 100 at a time. So it was definitely a step up. He also believed he had done what he could do as governor and was anxious for a national platform, a national stage to advocate for reform as well.
How did he work with the sort of party system at that point? Because you mentioned in the past he hadn't always been a favorite of the party bosses.
He wasn't. And he was elected in 1900, nominated, I should say, in 1900, by convincing the conservative Republicans that he wasn't so bad, and he sort of convinced himself that maybe they weren't so bad. But he was very pugnacious as governor his first term, and really became Fighting Bob, demanding and browbeating the legislature to do what he thought was best. And in 1902, it was a much harder convention fight, and he won the nomination again, but again, it was close. And in 1904, he nearly didn't. 1904 is the notorious Red Gym Convention. The Republican convention was meeting at the Red Gym, the Armory on the University of Wisconsin campus, and there was delegates who were contested. Different counties sent in delegates in pro-La Follette and then delegates who were anti-La Follette. It was on La Follette's home turf, and in order to guarantee that the right people were in this convention, he had University of Wisconsin football players as sort of bouncers, and barbed wire was erected around the gym, and delegates had to walk through in single file, and anyone who seemed or didn't have the right kind of credentials was bounced out.
A man ahead of his time.
Well, yeah, it's not Chicago in 68, but it was – the tensions ran pretty high, and conservatives, the stalwarts as they were called, stormed out, had their own convention a few blocks away, and nominated another Republican. Eventually, there's a Supreme Court case that gave La Follette the nominations that he was the legitimate Republican nomination.
Is that one reason he wanted to reform the primary system?
That's really at heart what's up with the primary elections. Because La Follette was such a skillful campaigner, and because he had seen how party bosses could manipulate who got nominated, primary elections seemed much more democratic, a way to ensure that the people could choose who would run. So before there was a general election in November, various Republican candidates would have to go before the voters, and the voters would pick who would win. Much more democratic, and La Follette had an advantage there. He was a great campaigner. I think never lost an election since primary elections went into effect. But to get back to the Senate, he's elected, takes office again in 1905. And in those days, this is before we have direct election of United States senators. The state legislatures elected senators. And they wanted a progressive. But who was that progressive going to be? And there were several different candidates vying for it, and there were several rounds of balloting among the legislature. And they were afraid that if there were two progressives running, they would divide the vote and they would elect a conservative. So La Follette steps in and says, I'll be a candidate. And he's immediately overwhelmingly elected United States Senator.
So it was a tempting path, because again, as you said, John, it smoothed his way toward a presidential bid.
That's right. He did stick around, though. He was elected in January 1905, stayed on to continue to see his program put into effect, and then resigned in January 1906 and then went to Washington. So 100 years ago this month is La Follette's return to the Congress as a senator.
And what did he find on the national scene at that point? It's January of 06, and there he is in Washington. What's happening?
Well, it's an exciting time to be in Washington because it's the middle of the progressive era, and Teddy Roosevelt is president. And Teddy Roosevelt is also a progressive Republican, also a reformer, and sort of a kindred spirit of Bob. They got off to a shaky start, of course. The first time Roosevelt met the La Follettes, Roosevelt being the energetic sort of person he was, he knocked a cup of coffee onto Bell's white dress. But they remained friendly. La Follette supported many of the progressive reform efforts that Roosevelt put in. But there is a difference. La Follette wanted the right kinds of measures passed, and Teddy Roosevelt wanted reform. And Roosevelt was willing to compromise and settle for half a loaf, as the phrase was. La Follette didn't want to settle. He thought it would be better not to get anything than to satisfy for something that would be mediocre or not the best, keep fighting for what was the best. So he was sort of a critic also of Teddy Roosevelt. An act to regulate railroads nationally, for example, the Hepburn Act, Roosevelt came out for it. La Follette was very hesitant about it. He didn't think it did enough. He wanted a national railroad board to regulate and control rates, and that couldn't get through Congress. So Teddy Roosevelt settled for second best, and La Follette wanted the whole thing.
They both had reputations for being pugnacious, right?
Certainly, and their paths cross regularly, and not always in a very friendly way, especially after World War I broke out, and Teddy Roosevelt was a very energetic, outspoken person for prosecuting the war, and La Follette wasn't.
And La Follette was the one who started then taking a considerable amount of flack, I think. This would have been around 1916 or 17 even?
It begins in 1916. He'd maintained his reputation in the Senate as a critic of the administration. He was critical of the more conservative Republican, William Howard Taft. He was critical of Woodrow Wilson, a Democrat. He worked with Wilson. They were cordial, but again, La Follette wanted more far-reaching reforms than Wilson wanted, more practical, wanted things that could get done. And the big division was foreign policy. The United States was experiencing conflict with Germany. World War I had begun in Europe, and U.S. ships were being sunk, and American civilians were being killed in the Atlantic Ocean. Wilson is trying to keep the country out of war, but is sort of drifting in that direction. And La Follette is opposed to war under any circumstances. So the first conflict comes in 1917. In March, Woodrow Wilson proposes a bill that would allow American merchant ships to fire on German submarines. La Follette opposed that and won a famous victory by filibustering that to death. The Congress was about to expire in the end of March, and he talked the bill to death, and the Senate expired before the law could be passed.
And what was Wilson's thinking on this, and why did La Follette oppose it? Because it was, by its very nature, an act of war to have armed merchant ships?
It was an act of war. American ships firing on German ships, it's an act of war. And La Follette was convinced that if that happened, inevitably there would be war.
So was he a pacifist, do you think, for sort of religious reasons, for... I mean, it would take a lot of courage to be one of the only ones speaking up against war as he did later on.
It did take a lot of courage, but he was not a pacifist. He opposed war for a couple of reasons. First of all, it was going to distract from the business at home. You can't engage in warfare and mobilize the country for war while at the same time trying to maintain reform efforts domestically. And the poor were the people who were going to suffer. When the war resolution is being debated in the Senate, La Follette gives a very ringing speech opposing it, telling the speaker that it was the poor who were going to rot in the trenches that would have to pay the price for this war, and those who were going to benefit were the people he had been fighting all his life, the big businesses, the bankers who had loaned money to Great Britain and France, people who were manufacturing war material and manufactured goods for Britain and France. So the war, from La Follette's perspective, was fundamentally undemocratic. American people were going to die to protect the investments of wealthy people.
When La Follette did his filibustering, when he got up and spoke about how it was the poor who were going to die in the trenches, what kind of comments started to come out about him or against him at that point?
Well, he became very quickly the most hated man in the country in many circles. The declaration of war, only six senators voted against it. He was one of six and the leader of this group of six that had opposed the war. One senator, Senator John Sharp Williams of Mississippi, gave a rejoinder on the floor of the Senate, and an equally impassioned pro-war speech calling La Follette unpatriotic. He called La Follette's anti-war statements pro-German, pretty nearly pro-Goth and pro-Vandal, anti-American Congress, anti-American people. And La Follette had to sit there and take this kind of abuse. His family suffered as well. La Follette was hanged in effigy and burned in effigy on college campuses. His children were accosted and spat upon in the streets in Madison and in Washington. It was not a happy time to be a member of the family.
Fortunately for America, the war didn't last that long, really only about a year and a half. So maybe a couple of years of this kind of suffering for fighting Bob before the business of the nation did move on to other things.
The business of the nation moved on in a couple of ways. There's great disillusionment, of course, that set in beginning in 1919 as American soldiers began to come home and people began to think, well, maybe La Follette was right. There is a sort of backlash against the activist reformist government of Roosevelt and Wilson. And there was a political moment as well. There was congressional elections in 1918, and suddenly the Senate is about evenly split between Republicans and Democrats. And so La Follette's vote becomes very, very important, and Republican leaders, Teddy Roosevelt had said La Follette should be shot as a traitor. They investigated charges of La Follette on libel and began a movement to expel him from the Senate. Suddenly the Republican leaders decided that maybe he wasn't so bad and they should keep him around. So he's sort of spared that way. But he never apologizes for his stance in against the war.
And he's reelected.
He's reelected overwhelmingly. He's reelected in 1922, getting something like 70% of the vote. And again, standing by his war record. Before the campaign got underway, he's giving an address in the state legislature. And everyone is telling him, don't talk about the war. It's past. You're fine. Don't bring it up. You're just going to open old wounds. He does anyway. And he tells this assembled audience, many of whom didn't like him that much, saying, I don't want any mistakes. I would not change my vote for anything. And there's this stunned silence. And suddenly everyone begins applauding and cheering. And one member of the audience said, I hate the son of a bitch, but my God, what guts he's got.
Yeah. Did that same strategy or way of operating carry through when he decided to run for president in 1924?
It did. It's the 1924 presidential campaign is really exciting. It is exciting to read newspaper accounts of his national tour that began in the fall. He goes from city to city, and it's the typical thing that happened is they'd have a hall, and there would be several people giving speeches, and he would come out late in the evening and give a rousing speech about the need for reform and the need for democracy. And people paid to hear these. People bought tickets to go hear them, and then they passed the hat. Of course, you know, this was very much grassroots organization, and trying to pay the bills was tough. And so how much money they collected often determined where they'd go the next night.
And did he think he had a chance?
He always said he did. They believed that they would win well in the Midwest, and they believed they would win in the West, in the mountain states and the Pacific Coast. California they expected to win, and Oregon, the Dakotas, for example, they thought that they would do well in. But the country was just too prosperous, and that river of discontent and dissatisfaction had dried up. He won Wisconsin, of course, so he got Wisconsin's electoral votes, and he ran second in many states in the West, but not enough to overwhelm Calvin Coolidge, the very popular incumbent.
Was he popular with the unions, La Follette?
Yes, he got a great deal of support from the unions. In fact, I believe the first time the American Federation of Labor ever endorsed a presidential candidate was to endorse Fighting Bob La Follette.
And what difference did it make that he ran? In other words, he lost except for Wisconsin. Did he influence the election or the policies after it by having run?
He certainly kept momentum going at a time when it was hard to be a progressive. The mood of the country had become quite conservative. Congress and the presidency were quite conservative. He really kept it going and kept the movement going during some very tough times. He really gave his life for it. That campaign killed him. He died a few months later in June of 1925, shortly after his 70th birthday.
But he passed that political legacy on to his children pretty clearly. I mean, we have a governor and at least two other politically active children that come from Robert La Follette.
That's very true, and they very self-consciously carried on the mantle. They believed they were inheriting this legacy and wanted to keep it going.
We're going to follow the next generation of the La Follettes when we continue with the University of the Year. Now we have the chance, 100 years after the great Fighting Bob La Follette, to send a message to Washington. Out of the upper Midwest will come political reform, will come political change, will come the principle of one person, one vote, once again. It's a comment by Russ Feingold the night of his reelection. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and our guest is Jonathan Kasparek. We're talking about the La Follette family in Wisconsin politics. We've now moved to the second generation after Bob La Follette dies when his presidential campaign fails. the legacy gets passed on to his children. Can you give us a sort of family tree here and tell us who are the children of Bob La Follette and which ones go on in politics?
Sure. Bob and Belle had four children. The oldest was Flora, whom very early on was called Fola, and that's the name that she adopted as her own. She was an actress, became very active in the suffrage movement as well, moved to New York. She married a playwright, George Middleton, and was very much involved in suffrage and the artistic scene in Greenwich Village. Didn't go into politics herself, but sort of maintained the legacy by continuing the biography of Fighting Bob that her mother began and publishing it in 1953. After Fola, Robert was born in 1895, Robert La Follette Jr., the heir to the magic name, and Philip La Follette, a younger boy, in 1897. And the younger daughter was born in 1900, Mary La Follette. And of those four, Robert Jr. and Phil are the ones that go into politics.
Same mantle pretty much as Fighting Bob, you say.
Progressivism. Very much so. They believed that La Follette's work hadn't been finished and they were going to continue the crusade. In 1925, La Follette died. The immediate question was what was going to happen to his Senate seat. And you can imagine all of the people in Wisconsin, or the politicians in Wisconsin, drooling over that opportunity. Many people wanted Belle to run, and that would have made her the first woman elected to the United States Senate, which I'm sure appealed to her. But she didn't want it. She was
didn't have the campaigning personality.
Well, I think didn't like the campaigning as much as her husband and her children did. And wanted to focus on starting the biography of her husband and carrying on that work. So the logical suggestion was one of the two sons, and here the decision was made for them. To be a United States senator, you have to be 30. Phil was a year too young, so Robert Jr. ran for a special election and was elected in 1925, became one of the youngest senators, and one of the most respected senators. He was not Fighting Bob. He was well-liked, respected in the Senate, even by people who didn't agree with his politics. He becomes a very good senator, presides over a civil liberties committee that investigates anti-union activity in corporations, came out for aggressive relief and unemployment funding during the Great Depression, is also opposed to World War II later on in the 1930s, and works to develop a congressional reorganization plan that in 1946 that worked quite well.
And there's room for more than one La Follette in state politics, state and national politics?
Well, there's room for more than one La Follette in the Senate. There are two senators from Wisconsin. And the younger son probably would have liked to run for the Senate. He was much more politically ambitious. Phil was a precocious boy. Robert was sort of shy and retiring and introspective. Phil was energetic and loved to chat with people and visit with the hobnob with the powerful people in Washington, who always were startled to find out that they were talking to this 6-year-old kid or this 8-year-old kid or this 12-year-old kid at official receptions. He liked politics and he liked campaigning and he was very, very good at it. Robert Jr. had a hard time at first campaigning. His early campaign speeches were flops. Phil took to it and he could campaign with the best of them and take on hecklers and carry on the same kind of energy that his father could.
At this point, with the Depression hitting the country, what difference did that make to the kinds of things that both Robert and Philip were doing?
The Depression for both of the La Follette brothers, but particularly for Phil. Phil was always sort of academic. He would have made a very good professor, I think. It was nothing new. It was not unexpected. This is what the progressives have been talking about for 30 years. And for him, it was the latest in this ongoing battle between democracy and the influence of corporate power. And for him, it was the opportunity to do something. It was the great opportunity to finally enact progressive reforms. So he's elected in 1930. He defeats the incumbent governor, Walter Kohler, the plumbing magnate, for the Republican nomination and goes on to win the general election. And immediately he impresses everybody not only by his campaigning style, his vigor and energy, but by his thoughtfulness. For example, in his inaugural address, he's just taken office at this difficult time, and he sort of defines the progressive take on what's going on. He says, "As a state and a nation, we have astounded the world in production. Our energy and brains have shown the world how to produce the necessities and luxuries of life in sufficient quantities to satisfy the needs of all people. But In the midst of this abundance of agricultural and industrial production, we have want and suffering. Unless we can solve the problem of the distribution of this abundance, unless we can stop hunger and hardship and all of this plenty, we will be the actors in the greatest tragedy of human history. It wasn't a new thing. This was history, and Phil was... This was civilization itself at stake, and the progressives were going to save it.
One thing that the La Follettes we've seen so far have that perhaps set them apart from most politicians, they do have vision.
They have
the
vision.
They're not just running for office. They actually have a mission.
That's particularly true with Phil. He could focus on the day-to-day activities, but he was a big-picture person, and he knew what had to be done to make the country better. And he was very good at communicating that and convincing voters that we can do better. A great motivator.
And how did he handle charges, oh, you're a socialist, you're a communist? Because some of the aims of distributing wealth more equitably would overlap.
Well, he was called a socialist and a communist, and much worse. When he was a young man, he sort of liked it. He liked to fancy himself as sort of the college radical. And he was always more radical, I think, than his father had been. But the La Follettes were never communists, never socialists. They believed in private property, and they believed in responsible capitalism. They weren't trying to punish capitalists. They just wanted them to play by the rules and be fair.
And they favored, I gather, as progressives, a greater role for government in people's everyday lives?
That's right. And the Depression gives us a perfect example of that. The big issue in the 1930 and 1931 was unemployment. Wisconsin manufacturing was contracting, and people were losing their jobs. Nationwide, by 1933, we had an unemployment rate nearing 33%, which is unthinkable today. Well, La Follette put together a group of people, John Commons of the University of Wisconsin, Harold Groves also of the university. Let's do something about it. We're smart. We can figure this out. So what they came up with was the first unemployment compensation plan in the nation. And it's very progressive. It's not just giving a handout to people who lost their jobs. It was designed to alleviate unemployed, to keep people having purchasing power, to keep the economy moving. But it was also designed to prevent unemployment. And I think that's the key element there. It wasn't just to relieve unemployment, it was to prevent it. It worked like this. Every firm had to pay into an insurance fund, a dollar amount per employee. When that level reached a certain amount, they could stop paying into it. And then if they laid people off, and they started drawing on that fund for unemployment, then they had to start putting back into it. So there was a financial incentive for companies to not fire people and to keep them working. So the idea was not just to provide aid to families, it did that certainly, but to prevent unemployment altogether.
So we're talking by, what, 1931 or so? By the time Phil has become governor, he's already implemented some of these things?
Unemployment compensation goes into effect in January 1932. That's when he signs the bill, 3 years before Social Security.
And I was going to say the good year before FDR becomes president.
But FDR is watching. FDR is the governor of New York, and he's paying attention.
And how does Philip handle the parties at this point, the Republicans and the Democrats and so on?
Well, this is interesting, and this is where Phil really demonstrates his ability as a politician, as an organizer. Franklin Roosevelt is watching from New York, and Roosevelt has made up his mind he's going to run for president as a Democrat. Republicans, in a period of bad time, they're sitting ducks, and the Democrats are looking forward to recapturing the White House. And Roosevelt is, of course, a very glad-handing campaigner himself, a very appealing candidate. And this is a problem. And Phil knows well ahead of time when Wisconsin's presidential preference primary is held in April, there is a tremendous outpouring of Democratic voters to vote for Roosevelt, more than have ever voted Democratic in recent years. And he knows this is trouble. In September, he's running for renomination as a Republican. And lots of voters who had voted for progressive Republican candidates in the past, like Phil and like Robert Jr., suddenly switched ballots and voted in the Democratic primary. And as a result, Phil lost this base of support. Conservative Republicans won the Republican primaries and Phil's out of office. A very embarrassment for him. He's very hurt by that.
After 2 years as governor.
A very successful 2 years as governor. So this resurgent Democratic Party is a problem for the La Follettes.
How can you be a reforming Republican when you have reforming Democrats
who are suddenly doing better
on the national stage? It must have been a real identity crisis from a party standpoint.
It was. And people had been talking quietly about the need for more organization among progressives for a long time, and this was a good opportunity. Ironically, the primary election was one of the hardest things the progressives had to deal with, because how do you run primary elections and pick progressive candidates without dividing up the vote and allowing the nomination and election of a conservative candidate? I mean, you have to win primary elections, and progressives had a very mixed record in the 1920s of doing that. So Phil's idea was to pull all of the progressive supporters out of the Republican Party, put together an alliance with progressive Democrats, socialists from Milwaukee, and
create a third party, the Progressive Party. Yeah.
Well, it was a tough assignment, and they had a lot of roadblocks, and Phil is really the driving force that gets it through. And they call themselves progressives, which also was not a foregone conclusion. There were those who wanted a more radical farmer labor party, as had been created in Minnesota. But Phil convinces them that progressive still is powerful.
And does he get back in office?
He does indeed. The party does very, very well in its first election in 1934. Phil is reelected governor, elected again governor, I should say. They capture 7 of the 10 congressional seats. Robert Jr. is reelected as the United States Senator on the progressive ticket. They capture control of the assembly and almost of the state senate.
Now, you had mentioned that the other famous Wisconsin politician was Joe McCarthy. How does he sort of collide with his family?
He collides with his family at the end of the party. The Progressive Party does well for a few years. They have more gains in 1936. 1938 is a bad year for Phil. He wants to do what his father tried to do as well, sort of national third party. He doesn't believe Roosevelt's going to run for a third term, and this is a chance to perhaps a bid for the White House on a third-party ticket, perhaps, what his father was unable to do. So in 1938, he tries to put together a national political party, the National Progressives of America. And he begins talking about it on the radio, he begins organizing it, and he launches this thing at the Livestock Pavilion on the University of Wisconsin campus, this big open arena. He miscalculates. The timing is rather bad. Think about what's going on in Italy in 1938, what's going on in Germany in 1938.
It's the rise of fascism.
And fascism looked, if you looked at a film of
they're great orators.
Different. They're great orators, energetic orators, uh-huh. And there are some superficial similarities. And Phil made perhaps the greatest political blunder, I almost have to say the greatest political blunder in American history. He has to come up with a symbol for this new party. And what he comes up with is, to him, the sign of democracy. It is a circle with an X through it.
Oh, dear.
Which what he said, well, you go to vote in the voting booth, you mark an X through the circle, that's democracy. Well, standing up in front of this large circle X symbol behind him looked suspiciously like some other powerful symbol of the 1930s. In fact, one critic called it a circumcised swastika. And, of course, Phil is giving this energetic speech, launching this National Progressives. He doesn't have a lot of new ideas to offer. He's speaking in generalities. And the photographers that are there to capture this event have the misfortune, or perhaps good fortune, to get Phil, just as he's making a big point with his arm upraised in front of this ridiculous symbol. And after this event in April 1938, national leaders start to distance themselves from Phil, and they don't want anything to do with him. They didn't know what he was up to, and it was a little bit distasteful.
And by this time, there is a fair amount of sentiment in this country, is there not, favoring sides in the war that begins in Europe in 1939? I mean, this country is not by any means thoroughly isolationist.
It's an odd mix of not wanting to get involved but wanting the right people to win. And Phil probably could have recovered from this mistake, but once the war began in 1939 in Europe, he becomes an isolationist. And again, he's picking up from his father. This is not our war. If we go to war, it's going to cost democracy at home. We have to keep going with reform.
He and Lindbergh must be about the only ones on the national prominence.
It was a fairly widespread movement, the America First movement. Phil was tangentially involved but spoke about this, always in a very intelligent manner. And he made frequent comments about how much he detested the Nazis and detested Stalin. He had traveled in Europe and had been trailed by the Gestapo for a time because he was perceived as a threat. But you couldn't argue against intervention without at least appearing sympathetic. And to think that a La Follette might be sympathetic with dictatorship, most people should have known better. But he's sleeping with strange political bedfellows, really.
And was it really the end of the Progressive Party? In other words, that moment in the Stock Pavilion when he's caught looking bad and so on, is it downhill from then on?
It is downhill from there. Progressives do very badly in the 1938 election. Phil loses his last attempt at public office. Progressives lose control of the legislature as well. And Republicans become a resurgence. Progressives become sort of the third party. There's a bright spot there. In 1942, Orlin Loomis, as a progressive candidate, wins election and then dies a few days after election day, so never takes office. So he was the progressive who never sat. And after that, it was a slow, steady decline. And Robert Jr., who had never been that enthusiastic about the party to begin with, in 1946 decides, I'm going to run for re-election again, but I'm going to run as a Republican. And he tells all of his followers, I'm a Republican. The party disbands, and all of the supporters are supposed to go back to the Republican Party.
As you look back over the family in general, what do you think the most important legacy is today?
I think the most important legacy is not so much the specific reforms they enacted, but the idea. The idea of being patriotic means looking at the country and being critical and saying, we can do better. This is the most productive, wealthiest country in the history of the world. There's no reason why we have to have starving people. There's no reason we have to have unemployment. We can make this an ideal country if we really work at it and think about it carefully. And I think that's really an idea that endures still today. The La Follette name is still incredibly powerful in Wisconsin. We've got a La Follette Fighting Bob website and Fighting Bob Fest every fall in Baraboo. It's an exciting time, and people still are inspired by Fighting Bob and Fighting Phil.
Well, thank you for inspiring us for this hour, Jonathan Kasparek.
Thank you.
The author of Fighting Son, the first full-scale biography of Philip La Follette. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.